Now to how adaptive technology is helping legally blind PhD student Michael Whittaker navigate academia. In his 20s, Michael started losing his vision due to a progressive disorder. He was an international model at the time, and he still fits in some modelling assignments with his studies. Michael said he's had to adapt to living with a deteriorating sight, and he appreciates the help he's received from Blind Low Vision New Zealand. He also speaks openly about the common prejudices he's had to deal with. Now aged 32, he's at the University of Auckland working on a PhD in New Zealand literature, and he's focusing on the inaugural New Zealand Poet Laureate, Michelle Leggett, who also lives with the same progressive condition, retinitis pigmentosa. Michael is in the Tamaki Makaurau Auckland studio. Kia ora and welcome, Michael.
Kia ora, Catherine. Thank you for having me.
Michelle's a former guest of ours on 9 to Noon and a wonderful, wonderful poet. So tell me a little bit more about the PhD work you're doing on her. It's intensive stuff, isn't it, by this level?
It is, yeah. So I finished my master's and I'd been looking overseas in my sort of the direction of my study. And then in conversations with my supervisor, Lisa Samuels, I guess these somewhat uncanny similarities between my own experience and Michelle's lends her work to be lensed by me in an interesting way. And so we've, yeah, just been ploughing ahead with that for the last 2 years, another year or so to go.
What's been your experience of tertiary level education and the supports needed or the challenges posed to someone with vision issues?
Sure. So, you know, one of those, serendipitous things that I talk about is Michelle has expressed to me and also written and talked a little bit about her changing use of medium in terms of listening to books, using adaptive technology in the composition of her poetry. And, you know, fast forward 20, 25 years, and I'm using, I guess, this new generation of adaptive tech that makes that possible. Like, in my evolving experience with vision loss, all of these sort of inconceivable barriers barriers that are inconceivable to adapt to move past, it can be done. So I have these machines that I was fortunate to have Blind Low Vision sort of advocate for me to have those funded, and they read my text to me, they scan things, they're pretty marvelous. So I think some of the future for people with all manner of impairments is looking brighter.
That technology, it's getting more sophisticated listening to you. It's possibly also getting more expensive, especially in early iterations. And yes. What is the story for funding? Can you apply to the university for funding? Because obviously it's wonderful to have this technology, but it's frustrating when people can't access it.
Absolutely. So there are various ways to, try to even that playing field so that you can pursue the opportunities and possibilities that other people, you know, wouldn't even think twice about. For myself, that was through the Ministry of Social Development that Blind Low Vision kind of put their expertise to bat in terms of, first of all, kind of diagnosing what technology would best suit my needs and just navigate some of those things that would keep me out of employment and from getting where I want and have the desire and also ultimate capacity to get to with a little help and support.
It is an appalling statistic. I can't call it to mind now, but I remember the wonderful Minnie Baragwanath informing us on this.
Yes.
The unemployment, let's just say that shocking barriers to employment.
I think it's around 60% of blind, low vision and otherwise and sort of related impairment
That is a shocking statistic,
yeah,
isn't it?
Not good, is it?
And so are we seeing improvements in employers and or the Ministry of Social Development, which clearly has an interest in, for all sorts of reasons, in having people in work. Are we seeing improvements in the availability, Michael, or are you hearing it is still a struggle for men?
I think in my own experience, I have noticed a profound change in perspectives with open-mindedness and dialogue around what the possibilities are rather than the limitations. So I would like to, I suppose, have an optimistic viewpoint towards that continuing in the future.
This is a life story for you, and I wonder if you could take us a little on the journey, because there are so many components to this. There are the emotional components. There are the kind of personal self-identity components, and there are also just the things that you love doing that become more difficult progressively over time. Mm. Could you take us back, I guess, to when you first realised that you had vision issues and perhaps this particular diagnosis? When does it typically become diagnosed, Michael?
I believe, in my case at least, it wasn't until my 20s. I don't think that's atypical, but like the nature of many of these impairments, you know, there's a vast spectrum of where they present and how. But in my case, it was I was in Tokyo, and I was doing a modeling contract there for Comme des Garçons, which is a kind of pretty famed Japanese design house. And in the evenings, I just realized that I had no night vision whatsoever. So that was a bit of a shock, and I just wanted to, you know, get to the bottom of it. So came back to New Zealand and had that diagnosis and started some treatments to, I guess, prolong my remaining sight. But I certainly thought I was getting to the bottom of it, but it was really just the beginning of, another story.
Could you elaborate?
Well, I suppose that was in my early 20s. I continued to work and live and get treatment overseas for the next several years in the modeling industry, and finished up my undergraduate studies in New York, and then somewhat settled down back in New Zealand some years ago, and now I've just been, you know, some people would say moving in quite a different direction to the fashion industry, and throwing myself into academia, and I'm very happy for it.
The literature, has it always been a love of yours?
It has, yeah. I think it's just been a consistent source of interest and exploration for me. And so to do this professionally, somewhat professionally, but to study someone like Michelle, who in some ways, you know, I has created a roadmap of some of the feelings, the themes, the experiences that I can identify with, but also someone who has made beautiful art of something that other people potentially would, you know, dismiss as a sort of residual existence. But I find we are all better for having read and looked to what she's made of this experience.
It's perfect in many ways, isn't it? From a personal perspective as well as an academic interest in her work.
Yes.
There are layers to it. What have been the prejudices along the way? The challenges can be overcome, and goodness, you and many others do that every day of your lives and achieve. But what are some of the prejudices that do harm?
Sure. I think in my own experience throughout my 20s, there was, and even recently, it's something that I continue to perhaps navigate each day is like just this desire to mask or minimize or downplay the role that it takes in my life, that it plays in my life, while also trying to champion the idea that this is just one arrow to the quiver and of my identity, I suppose.
Of course.
But certainly just, I think in my experience seeking out these role models, Michelle plays that role for me in some ways, but organizations like Blind Low Vision can help to mentor you through some of those really difficult expectations around your, I guess, like cultural disappearance. This really bleak vision of what living with low vision or blindness can be. And I think that I, in many ways, did it through relentless trial and error. And some of that stuff can just be efficiently avoided in seeking out necessary help in a timely fashion.
That's interesting. So you tried to do a lot on your own?
Yeah, certainly just out of that, I guess, internalized embarrassment about incompetence or, also just not wanting to have to address necessarily everyone else's preconceptions about what blindness entails. In particular, this simple idea that you are either sighted or you are blind, whereas I think the majority, if not up to 90% of people who we would call blind, actually have a degree of, visual perception. But, just these performative aspects where you don't want to rock the boat, and that can mean that you don't really feel like getting out of the house, because there's a whole raft of things that you're building. And so I think building confidence or rebuilding confidence is something that I've found a little bit of an uphill battle at times, but certainly one that isn't insurmountable.
Is there a grief? And I know yours is a progressive condition. There's not one moment before and after, which requires constant adaptation. I don't know whether that is a constructive thing because you can adapt progressively, or whether it's frustrating because you have something sorted out and now you must adjust again. But is there a grief? Was there for you at some point anyway a grief for what was happening?
I think in this continuum of my experience, I don't feel like my kind of inherent sense of personhood has been in any way like impinged upon, and so that's what I focus on is reckoning with the possible, as one philosopher says it, and finding this like satisfaction, meaning, fulfillment in what I can achieve, what is possible to enjoyably engage in the world. And I find there's, strangely enough, a kind of equivalence or relativity in seeking out those avenues of enjoyment. So in terms of grief, I feel like maybe frustration would be closer to my experience in sort of just this being perceived of as such an all-consuming part of my personality and outlook. And just looking to people like Michelle, who certainly address, thematics of despair and disorientation and sensory redistribution, but also a sense of possibility and potential for discovery in this realm of mystery and intrigue that that comes from the loss of the sight, but also the exploration of a world that still remains fascinating and full of life.
It comes to perspective, and yes, you have yours, and what you deal with is everyone else's. I understand. You're an athlete too. I think you've just been competing in some championships.
Yes, I was down in Christchurch this last weekend for the National Road Relays, which, due to a last-minute venue change, actually ended up being run at an alternate venue in the Forest, which presented some interesting moments for myself and my running guide, who I run with a tether. But as you can imagine, an uneven off-road
pine
surface.
Pine cones and things.
Yeah. So I was sort of getting yanked all over the place. But, you know, maybe a nice, like, analogy for something that seems ludicrous and ill-advised in terms of, like, running at quite competitive speeds now with limited eyesight. But
10Ks, isn't it? That is, to me, it's actually the ultimate speed race. It's about the longest you can persist at a very high tempo. I look at the Olympic marathoners and they seem to run an entire marathon at that tempo. But there's something about that 10K distance that maximises speed versus stamina.
Yeah, there's that, and there's also just like skills that I'm picking up about, I guess, manually, like lowering my heart rate, because you know, I'll be in these stressful situations where it's like I just about, you know, nearly broke my ankle there. Like, how do I calm the breathing? How do I get, you know, this resilience to deal with those obstacles while maintaining my eye on, you know, finishing the race and running well and enjoying my body in this particular way.
So what will you do a 10K in?
I think we came in somewhere around like 35 minutes.
Oh my God! It's...
But you know, there are so many levels. Like are, you know, you can feel like you're getting pretty fast, and then get quickly humbled.
Yeah, but still, that's a fast run. With your academia, it's just occurring to me actually that it's such a demanding course all the way through to PhD, but. The amount of reading that is required in one form or another, have you learned to pace yourself, I guess, through the course of the postgrad and now on to the PhD?
Yeah, it's certainly the landscape of how I learn, I think, has changed. Like I look back at my master's, which I conducted with significantly more vision than I have now, and just the... like the depth of reading, which I was able to do, lent itself really well to that project. I think with someone like Michelle's work, in that no one else has done like a single author PhD, and presumably and hopefully a book which will be a bit more widely accessible to people interested in her work, is that there is quite a lot of scope for, I guess, original thought and some generative readings there. And so, I feel like that lends itself to a bit not quite the same kind of bibliographic reading as maybe some of my last work.
What beyond this? I know that's a ridiculous thing to say to someone doing a PhD because it's like a tunnel from which you've not yet emerged and it's so all-encompassing. But what beyond this? Do you envisage teaching in academia, writing? What's ahead?
Absolutely. So I'm looking at some courses for teaching next year, and you know that's a gift to be able to engage with students. And also see some of that kind of like, I guess, like the focus on diversity of perspectives starting to come through, perhaps in students of this generation. I find that quite uplifting. Looking forward and gathering confidence in writing, but as Michelle Leggett kind of, I think, very aptly said. She is a poet. She's not a blind poet. You know, she writes about all aspects of life. So again, this is an aspect of my personality and others' personality, but it doesn't have to be kind of a sign sealed and delivered destiny.
Real pleasure, Michael. Thanks. I'm sure we'll talk again. Thanks for your time and all the best for that incredible achievement that is as a PhD and all the ups and downs along the way. Thank you. Michael Whittaker.